Hey, hi. Are you awake? Are you feeling okay? You just fell asleep right in the middle of our session. Has this been happening often? Oh, okay. I'll note down fatigue as one of the symptoms then. Fatigue. All right, that concludes our assessment. I'm just going to review my notes before I can give you a diagnosis. So, based on your symptoms of fatigue, mood swings, headaches, diarrhea, you have met the diagnostic criteria for nostalgia. Yes, nostalgia. Why are you laughing? It can be an often fatal disease. Many Americans in the Civil War died from nostalgia. That diagnosis doesn't feel right? Well, you said you don't have kids. Can you confirm if that's true again? Because these symptoms could also point to lactational insanity. Lactational insanity. Lactational insanity. Oh, it's when you nurse your child too much with your breasts and it makes you go cuckoo. I know your husband got diagnosed with neurasthenia, and I understand why you think you might have it, but as you know, neurasthenia only happens to men. Here, to make things easier for you, I will just write your diagnosis as hysteria. That'll make it easier for you to bond with your hysterical lady friends. A common motivation for getting a psychiatric diagnosis is to receive clarity about your life and yourself. Why do I get overwhelmed by noises that others don't seem to notice? Why can't I remember things that are important to my partner no matter how hard I try? If I could just connect these problems to a concrete medical category with set symptoms and treatment, then everything will make sense. Unfortunately, many people who go through the mental health system will tell you that it's not that smooth of a process. I heard from a friend named Via Sanali that their family doctor referred them to a psychiatrist for PTSD, only for the psychiatrist to diagnose them with BPD. Then, as they went through various forms of therapy and spoke with others diagnosed with BPD, some of them, all being women, were getting re-diagnosed with autism. My close friend dug deeper and found a history of debate in psychiatry and philosophy about whether BPD should be a diagnostic category. Some people theorize that women make up 75% of BPD diagnoses because many of them are autistic women who have been misdiagnosed because they don't fit the masculine stereotypes around autism. People tend to treat psychiatric categories as fixed and deeply real. Many people assume that the realness of these categories is grounded in biology.
We, as people with ADHD, literally have zero internal motivation.
Your body goes through something called pruning, where it deletes and gets rid of all of the synapses that you do not use. Research has shown that this does not occur in people with autism. So we just have too many synapses in places that they're not supposed to be at. This is why autistic people tend to get overstimulated, because they have connections in the brain that would have been otherwise deleted in non-autistic people.
But a quick look through history will show that what we take to be real in a seemingly objective science is not straightforward at all. Today, nostalgia is understood as a romantic, perhaps bittersweet feeling about the past. But during the Civil War in America, you could get diagnosed with nostalgia or homesickness, which was understood as an often fatal disease. In the 19th to early 20th century, mothers could get diagnosed with lactational insanity. If a mama's jugs were too big and fruitful, they could go insane. Under the belief that women were less reasonable and more similar to animals, ruled by their bodies rather than culture, there was a plethora of mental illnesses centered around a woman's body parts, their breasts, ovaries, and even noses. Procedures such as removing the clitoris or reshaping a woman's nose were prescribed to mentally disordered female patients. The 19th century also brought about drapetomania, the mental illness a black slave had when they wanted to run away from their master. In the view of many white doctors, black people were inherently prone to insanity and unreason. So just as how the white mentally ill population got put into asylums for treatment, slavery was the asylum for black people. To defy slavery was to defy their nature, and mental illness was a convenient, seemingly apolitical category to justify slavery. These diagnoses probably sound ridiculous to you, But all these mental illnesses seemed very real to doctors and regular folk living at that time. It might make you take a second look at our own psychiatric categories today. What sits in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM, today that will be removed in the next 20 years? For example, autism used to be a symptom of reduced emotions in schizophrenia, but today it stands as an independent diagnosis. A big reason why ADHD exists as a diagnosis is because pharmaceutical companies first created the drug Ritalin, and then decided they needed a category of people to sell the drug to. This naturally leads me to wonder what purpose a formal diagnosis actually serves. The previous directors of the National Institute of Mental Health in America said they hope to one day find the precise biological cause of mental illness and disorders.
One of the projects that we're supporting is to find biological markers, which are clinically meaningful measures in people that can help us understand autism spectrum disorder.
Many leaders in the mental health field believe that psychiatry is reducible to a, quote, sickness of the brain, not of the self or society. As a result, much of the Western psychiatric model is highly individualistic. It treats psychiatric conditions as isolated from culture. The purpose of a diagnosis, it seems, is to tell you that something is going on in your brain and that you can take a drug or attend therapy to subdue this individual problem.
Models in the latest fashions are said to look Prozac deprived.
Before long, the name was on everyone's tongue.
I was on Prozac for a long time.
And it seemed everyone was using it.
6 million Americans using Prozac right now.
Receiving a formal diagnosis might grant you better accommodations at work or school, but as most people with a mental disability share, it often can work against them. For example, formally, there are discrimination laws that prohibit employers from mistreating you, firing you, or not hiring you on the basis of a disability. But so long as they don't say they're doing that, you're going to find very few paths for recourse. Moreover, giving someone accommodations is an individualistic solution because psychiatric diagnoses are seen as an individual deviation from what is quote-unquote normal or neurotypical. You are autistic purely because of your neurological state, and so we will give you a 3-day grace period with assignments. Accommodations are there to help individuals conform to normal neurotypical expectations, but accommodations do not question expectations themselves. As I'll discuss later in this video, the neurotypical ideal is hard to attain for most people, including most neurotypicals. This is an important factor in understanding the growing mainstream interest in neurodivergence. Lastly, this brings us to the fundamental philosophical question about the nature of things. Are psychiatric diagnoses real? Before we continue, I want to be clear about the goals of this video. If you're looking for someone to tell you that people are just weak these days and the increase of autism and ADHD diagnoses are fake, then this video is not for you. But if you're looking for someone to say that the only reason why autism and ADHD diagnoses are increasing is because more autistic and ADHD people are being discovered, this is also not the video for you. What I do hope you get out of this video is how these patterns we see with autism and ADHD recently represent the complex cultural and historical influences on psychiatry. This requires a comprehensive view of history, something often lacking in our fast-paced digital world. I encourage you to step out of the shoes of a 21st century citizen. Remove your assumptions about what is natural and normal, what is neurotypical versus neurodivergent, so that we can see how psychiatric labels change depending on their cultural utility. Quote, "It is not the consciousness of men that determines their existence, but their social existence that determines their consciousness."
Hugh Heyman. J'ai peur. De quoi avez-vous peur?
Us psychiatrists have fought hard to be taken seriously by other health professionals. It wasn't easy to convince the medical field that people could suffer from psychological pain separate from the body, or that the insane or mad needed treatment. When my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather started hearing voices, he became a prophet. Us psychiatrists have also been quite divided as a community. Some of us took up psychoanalysis from Freud, Freud, which fluctuated in popularity. Others were medical pick-me's and craved Dr. Daddy's approval. Please, Dr. Daddy, please, I'm a real science too. I look at genes and brain scans. I know how to quantify human experience too. Today, the biosocial model is often used in diagnoses, but let's face it, the bio is written first for a reason. There's an abundance of medical research today trying to explain mental conditions as purely biological. For example, some researchers are trying to associate certain brain patterns with certain mental disabilities. So even if you don't experience symptoms of, say, ADHD, or you don't feel impacted by them, if your brain looks a certain way, then you can still be medicated. That way, you can sell your child at risk of autism for $300 so you can spend money on pills every month because your doctor said you're at risk for ADHD. This is the process of medicalization. Quote, the social process whereby problems that were previously perceived as non-medical became defined and accordingly treated as medical problems. Now, I want to make this loud and clear for my colleagues and the public. I do not think it is inherently bad to medicalize something. It's pretty awesome that we medicalize things like cancer, which people used to believe was caused by not enough sex. I am very happy that there's medication to help with psychosis. But not everything works better under a medical model. The historical development of psychiatric conditions shows just how much influence culture has. The brain is also immensely complex. I cannot stress that enough. A lot remains unknown about the brain compared to all our other organs. Now, according to my list of patients, I have slightly more male patients. So why don't we take a look at an example from World War I? Because all boys like war, of course. You know, I think it's the penis-shaped bullets. They produce a phallic infatuation. PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, is one of the more well-known diagnoses in the DSM. A paradigmatic case of PTSD is when a soldier returns from war and experiences symptoms such as flashbacks and severe anxiety, as though they could be transported back to the battlefield at any moment. But the term PTSD did not exist during World War I. Instead, soldiers were being diagnosed with shell shock. Now, people tend to think of shell shock as a precursor to PTSD, either claiming that shell shock and PTSD are two words for the same thing, or that PTSD is a more refined, more accurate version of shell shock. Both thoughts are sort of true, but we've already started off on a flawed assumption, namely that psychiatric conditions exist objectively out there in the world, and we just have to uncover them. It's understandable why people think this way. After all, psychiatry is a medical science, and isn't science about discovering objective facts of the world? This is where my recommendation to step out of the shoes of a 21st century citizen comes into play. The facade of stable objectivity tends to fall apart once you transport yourself into a different historical moment. During World War I, there were only 50 psychiatrists in the US military for over 4 million people in the army. As a result, most military personnel were being treated by people who had no psychiatric training at all. Back then, psychiatry was not an established branch of medicine like it is today. Medical professionals, by and large, treated physical symptoms only. Soldiers knew this, and so their bodies subconsciously produced a variety of physical symptoms to communicate their pain, such as paralysis, restrictions in joint movement, mutinous or deafness, constipation, and insomnia. Even within the military, there was a difference in the expression of symptoms depending on your ranking. During the World War I era, there was a condition called neurasthenia, which was associated with urban, middle to upper class men who just worked too hard. Their strenuous intellectual work was said to cause headaches, fatigue, vertigo, and aches. As such, it was desirable to have neurasthenia. Interestingly then, the higher the rank of a military officer, the more their symptoms resembled neurasthenia and not shell shock. This is an example of conversion, the translation of our feelings and experiences into culturally acceptable language and gestures. What might be even more interesting is that doctors initially referred to the soldiers' conditions as hysteria, but that didn't end up sticking. Not because the soldiers didn't have hysteria, but in large part because hysteria implied femininity, and that would stigmatize these manly soldiers. So doctors diagnosed soldiers with shell shock, not hysteria, so that they wouldn't feel shame in seeking help. Meanwhile, doctors diagnosed female nurses on the battlefield with hysteria, even though they had the same symptoms as the soldiers. If you had shell shock, you were considered courageous and injured in combat. You had a damn good reason to be acting up. But if you had hysteria, Well, you were just weak-willed and overdramatic. We learn an important lesson here. Psychiatric conditions are strongly influenced by culture. Quote, the story of any sickness is one that doctors and patients weave together, in which they find consensus about what constitutes a culturally legitimate and sensible symptom at a particular moment in history. In 1917, it didn't make sense to most of society to have psychological wounds, and so soldiers learned how to express their symptoms physically. Even though doctors knew that shell shock was just another term for hysteria, it was culturally useful for them to have these two different diagnoses. And by culturally useful, I mean useful in upholding patriarchal culture. Diagnose first-class citizens like white soldiers with shell shock, and second-class citizens such as women and immigrants with hysteria. Now, it would be wrong to say that the people with shell shock had a completely different condition than people with PTSD today, but they also aren't two sides of the same coin. Each diagnosis was created to understand a particular kind of pain in a culturally acceptable way. Shell shock existed because of a certain culture, and PTSD exists today because of a different culture. Shell shock represents a culture when illnesses were thought to reside only in the body, and only white men could have valid deviations from what was normal. PTSD represents a culture where psychological suffering is acknowledged, and all people, not just soldiers, have a valid claim to trauma. But although PTSD is widely intelligible in Western societies today, it is not a diagnosis in communities that speak about historical trauma. PTSD only exists in an individualistic culture that believes that trauma resides in the individual. What I'm trying to get at with this shell shock PTSD example is similar to how in ancient Greece, it was common practice for an older man and a younger man to have a romantic and/or sexual relationship. But it's not 100% accurate to call them gay, because they didn't see man-to-man relationships as constituting a sexual identity. Engaging in gay behavior didn't turn you into a type of person called gay. You were just mentor and mentee. A man from ancient Greece and a gay person today share behavioral and emotional patterns, just as how people with shell shock and people with PTSD share behavioral and emotional patterns. But these two groups of people interpreted and expressed their experiences differently. Now I'm going to get a little abstract here on because it's theory time, but bear with me. What theory grounds the examples we've been talking about? If it helps to understand what I'm asking, you can picture the differentiation many people make between theory and application. We've analyzed the shell shock PTSD hysteria case, which is an implied example, but what theory is it an application of?
Colonial Hills Hospital is located in Northwest San Antonio. Over the years, it has come to symbolize hope for those who are drawn to its professional, caring environment.
There once was a psychiatrist named Franz Fanon. During the Algerian Revolution, Fanon was stationed in the psychiatric hospital of Ville de Joinville of Algeria, where he treated patients from both the French and the Algerian side. But he ended up resigning from the psychiatric hospital. He saw psychiatry as ill-suited for what it claimed to do. Psychiatry supposedly was a medical technique to help integrate people into society so that they could, quote, no longer be a stranger to their environment. But it failed to do this because Algeria had a social structure of systemized dehumanization. When others determine what a true human or woman or French citizen is, how could you be anything but a stranger to your environment?
Rien ici ne vous appartient. Visage désespéré, ventre résigné. Et qu'importe si ce pays est beau. Et je préfère m'arrêter là.
Let me show you what I mean. I'm going to conduct what's called the thematic apperception test, or TAT, on you. See this photo? Okay, take your time to look at it. Pause the video if you'd like, and simply let your imagination run free. Think about what's going on in the photo. Now, tell me what you see. What I'm looking for in your answer is to see whether you can create a coherent narrative about the photo, and whether you are perceptually skilled. Can you make up a story that makes sense? Do you pick up on all of the visual details in the photo? Now, this might seem like an unbiased test. I didn't place any constraints on what you were to do. I just told you to imagine something, anything. However you like, I didn't have one right answer I was looking for. Yet, can you guess what photos were always chosen when Fanon practiced TAT on his Algerian patients? They were always photos of white French people in France. Quote, colonialism tries to craft the imagination of the Muslim woman as if she were European. Under oppressive social conditions, psychiatry worked to impose oppressive habits onto its patients. Diagnosing someone with hysteria made her hysterical. It imposed this identity of hysterical onto someone. I had a friend once share with me their experience of receiving multiple diagnoses throughout their life. When they were diagnosed with depression, they interpreted all their feelings and actions through the framework of a depressed patient. They couldn't get tasks done on time because they were low on energy. They couldn't get out of bed unless they took antidepressants. A few years later, they were told by psychiatrists, "You are not depressed, you just have ADHD." Suddenly, everything in their life was interpreted through the framework of ADHD. They couldn't get tasks done on time because of ADHD time blindness. They couldn't get out of bed unless they took Vyvanse. This is not to discredit the value people find in diagnoses. We need categories to make sense of the world and ourselves. Categories track our cultural values. I am not accusing people with autism or ADHD or OCD of lying. Heck, I'm a psychiatrist. I'd be put out of business if I thought that. Differences in how people interpret social interactions, how they handle emotions, and so forth, and the hardships they face because of these differences are real. Some people really do have sensory sensitivities that others don't. Some people genuinely struggle with verbal communication. But how we group symptoms together, what makes sense as a symptom, and what symptoms are expressed are culturally and historically dependent. Again, autism used to just be a symptom of schizophrenia. American doctors once saw the desire of a slave to escape from their master as a medical symptom. In World War I, high-ranking versus low-ranking soldiers expressed different symptoms depending on what was expected of their social class. There's a tendency to think of history as the past, where people were just weird and wrong. But the present is part of history. Yesterday has now become history, and so is this very moment where you're watching me on a digital device. We cannot understand current psychiatric trends without this historical awareness.
President Donald Trump and HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. have both said that it's critical to find the cause of autism. In a statement today, Kennedy said, quote, "The HHS is assembling teams of world-class scientists to focus research on the origins of the epidemic," as he calls it.
With all this talk about neurodivergence online, you've likely heard of its supposed opposite, neurotypicality. Neurotypicals act normal or exhibit standard forms of behavior. Neurodivergents deviate from this standard. But what exactly is expected of a neurotypical?
Hi!
And how are you?
I'm good, and how are you?
Yes!
Some weather we're having, huh?
Okay, so the neurotypical excels, or at least does fine under the 9-to-5 cubicle workday. They don't struggle with adhering to social norms of expression. They can regulate their emotions by themselves. Wait, who is actually this perfect?
Where are the neurotypicals? What are they doing? Who are they? What do they act like?
What becomes apparent is that neurotypicality is an ideal, a culturally oppressive standard that harms most people, including neurotypicals. Devin Price, a social psychologist and professor who is also autistic, makes an analogy between neurotypicality and heteronormativity. Heteronormativity obviously hurts queer people the most, but it also hurts hetero people. Heteronormativity is not just the expectation to like someone of the opposite sex. It also involves the right expectations about how to like them. A boy and a girl meet. They start dating. The boy fulfills the masculine role, and the girl contributes her feminine energy. After a few years, they get married, move in together, and stay together for the rest of their lives. Many people who are heterosexual deviate from this standard, and also feel shame because of it. Maybe you don't want to get married and have people question whether you truly love each other. When the girlfriend makes more money or does more traditionally masculine roles, the girlfriend gets judged for not having self-respect, and the boyfriend gets judged for not being a proper boyfriend. Similarly, neurotypicality hurts neurodivergent folk the most, but it also hurts neurotypical folk. The expectation to be a totally self-sufficient individual who always acts rationally is unsustainable for everyone. It is common to feel distress after a traumatic event, or to feel anxious before a job interview, but now people feel like they only have a legitimate claim to pain and hardship if they have a diagnosis like autism or anxiety. The dominance of psychiatric language is resulting in what philosophers of knowledge have called contributory injustice. Concepts often improve our knowledge, creating the concept of postpartum depression, for example, helped many mothers understand why they were feeling so terrible, and prevented people from blaming mothers for not being motherly enough. But psychiatric language now dominates so many aspects of life that people struggle to see the world through any other concept. This is an epistemic injustice, an injustice in our ability to know and understand things. People cannot understand things in a non-psychiatric way.
Everyone in my life is white, and they go, that guy's autistic. I go, I agree.
Exactly. No, but we don't do that in, like, other cultures.
What cultures do we not do that in?
Latin culture, we just go, that's Jose, and he likes to sweep. Like, you just let that guy rock. Raul's just good at numbers.
You just want to be like, let's be descriptive.
Yeah.
Without having to necessarily put a label on it.
Yes.
As someone closely connected with the neurodivergent label, it's understandable why a good chunk of neurodivergent folk are frustrated with the loose usage of categories like autism and ADHD. It undermines how difficult having autism and ADHD actually is. It makes everything not normal equivalent to autistic. God, the amount of times I've seen someone on social media just dressed a little quirky, or maybe they don't speak super smoothly, and there's tons of comments joking, is he acoustic? It has even led autistic individuals to be romantically fetishized.
I like him. I like that autistic man. And would I be wrong if I asked him at dinner, is you autistic? Because I like that.
But when autistic folk do not fit into this fetishized image of autism, they are belittled as they historically have been. The seemingly increased acceptance towards autism is only an acceptance of the symptoms that the culture now deems unproblematic. But at the end of the day, it would be misguided to point our fingers at individual actors. Psychiatry cannot be separated from historical values of productivity and work. For centuries, psychiatric asylums existed to confine anyone who is generally disruptive and unproductive. Lawbreakers, the unemployed, the unhoused, the physically disabled, and the strange were all put into the same asylums. What mattered was their shared lack of contribution to economic production. As such, when asylums were specifically designed for the insane in the 18th century, doctors defined diagnoses primarily in terms of the failure to function to serve the economy, a view that still lives on today in psychiatry. Several diagnoses are still described as functional impairments. Diagnoses like autism and ADHD are split between low functioning and high functioning. But think about what constitutes functioning. The autistic person who works 80 hours a week at a prestigious tech company but can barely find energy to cook at home or has sensory meltdowns at home is considered high functioning because their problems don't interfere with economic productivity. They're the good ones, you know, they keep their autism private. Their intense concentration on work is not a medical symptom called hyperfixation because to be overworked is normal, respectable even. Low-functioning autistic people might need regular support communicating with others, and their non-productive interest in IKEA furniture is labeled a hyperfixation, but they could be 10 times happier than someone labeled high-functioning. More and more people are identifying with neurodivergent labels because the capitalist expectations around work and productivity are getting harder to meet, and the culture has failed to provide people with language beyond psychiatry to understand this. The 8-hour workday is not great for most people, regardless of where they sit on the neurotypical to neurodivergent spectrum, especially since most people can't make a comfortable income off just one job anymore. They now gotta adopt 12-hour workdays or find some sort of side gig on the weekend. With most people being highly dependent on their phone, we are constantly tapped into tragic stories all over the world. We are constantly thinking about how others judge us on social media. Did I pick a cool caption? Why don't I look as pretty as her? Why did someone call me cringe on my TikTok when I didn't think it was cringe at all? Performing a specific image of ourselves is a regular occurrence in the average person's life. That's why Devin Price says unmasking is for everyone. Autistic and non-autistic people mask in different ways, but unmasking benefits all. A lot of people are stuck on a treadmill of following popular norms and expectations without truly being in touch with themselves. Improving work conditions to be more accessible and flexible is also good for everyone. Autistic folk require accommodations of a certain kind, but the general observation that the workplace needs improvement is true for most people. Quote, to acknowledge the needs of autistic workers is to listen to the canaries in the coal mine. Our sensitivities and needs help lay bare just how unfair many work expectations are, even for neurotypical people. For these reasons, it's not uncommon for psychiatrists to diagnose people with whatever they think will get them the services they would most benefit from. The DSM organizes diagnoses into clean, separate categories, but many psychiatrists know that diagnoses are not actually distinct in these clean ways. There is so much overlap between ADHD and autism, BPD and CPTSD, anxiety and depression, etc., etc. Moreover, a medical or psychological condition only exists if money is funneled into research, clinics, and studies that steadily produce these diagnoses. So sometimes, if one disorder becomes less stigmatized or is more attractive for research grants, it may be diagnosed more, which causes the number of other diagnoses with overlapping symptoms to decrease. As such, the total number of diagnoses or people using disability services might not actually change, even if the media makes it seem like everyone is autistic or has ADHD now. Crucially, this means that as a diagnosis becomes increasingly useful for a more diverse group of individuals, the differences between people with and without the diagnosis can decrease. So, are psychiatric diagnoses real? Yes and no. The diagnoses and symptoms we deem real are informed by what is culturally sensible and/or useful. So, if you think real means a biological, universal, and eternal entity, then no, psychiatric diagnoses aren't real. But that's the wrong way of looking at things. You're going to find that practically nothing is real under that definition. Autism, ADHD, OCD, PTSD. These categories coincide with how Western culture makes sense of the world and the individual. They are real because they function as real, and that's enough. And if in 50 years the DSM looks totally different, I wouldn't be too surprised. But that doesn't change what is real for people right now. There's a lot of research I did that didn't make it into this video, but I could only fit so much in one video in a coherent way. You can check out my research notes on Patreon. I also make short explanations of different philosophy papers or book chapters on Patreon in a series called the Brain Nourishment Series. I'd appreciate your support over there, and it's lots of fun if you can join the Discord. We've been playing Jackbox Party recently and trapping each other in moral dilemmas. I'm sure many of you, like myself, also feel like the world is an increasingly volatile place, which makes it difficult to keep up with the news. It doesn't help that most people get news through social media, but social media sites are known to shadow ban certain news topics, keep you within your algorithm's bubble, and distract you from serious news with brain rot. I tell you this because the sponsor of this video is Ground News, but I'm not going to act like Ground News is perfect. No news site can be perfect, especially with the goals that Ground News has. Ground News wants to be a tool to help you be more conscious of bias, to widen the scope of the news stories you encounter, and to make it easier for you to access articles. And it does just that, as a tool. Ground News is both an app and a website that collects related articles from more than 50,000 sources across the world and political spectrum, so you can compare how different outlets cover the same story. You can see the different headlines chosen by different news outlets for the same story, which helps you be more critical about their intentions. You can read which news stories are being underreported on by left or right-leaning news outlets in the blind spot feed. You can tailor your feed to specific topics or individuals and read them all without ever leaving the app or website. There's even a Ground News browser extension now that I use to help give me a summary of information at the top of any article I open. At the end of the day, Ground News is a tool to help you be critical and informed about the world. A car helps you get from point A to B, but the car won't do it by itself. You gotta learn how to use the car to help you. Same with Ground News. It's a great tool for critical thinking, but you should also critically think as you use it. I've been using Ground News for 2 years now? 2-3 years? It's been a long time. I don't know. I find it helpful, and if you want to try it out, visit ground.news/OliSunvia or scan my QR code to subscribe today. You can sign up now to get 40% off the same Vantage plan that I use. That's ground.news/OliSunvia or scan the QR code on screen. Thank you so much for watching. Regardless of whether you've gotten a psychiatric diagnosis in your life or not, regardless of whether you know someone who's had a psychiatric diagnosis or not, I'd love to hear your thoughts about what you think about psychiatry and the mental health system. Do you have any personal experiences you would want to share? Is there something important that you think I missed out on? Let me know. Thank you so much for watching. Let's keep talking, and I hope to hear from you soon. Bye! Of course, shout out to my Patreons who support this channel. Flo_G01, Wustache Witch, Dale Angelo, Survivor Soul, Rohan Prasad, Harmony, Louis Lusillon, Pink Bowie, Horace, Sean C, Joseph Rachmin, Burrow Fiddle, Francis X Stefanik, ZKH, Justin Hollingsworth, Victor Pahuamba, William Bowen, Riallo, Cyrus Orion, Malpertuis, Lucas Kaiser, Farman Panu, Jiao Goncalves, Bonzo, and Dhruv Singhal. Thank you.